forecast at 5:30, 7 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This week, the first week of the new year, 2023, we are rebroadcasting some of our most noteworthy author interviews from 2022. I hope you enjoy today's program. We are more and more mindful of people who, for various reasons and under various circumstances, find themselves displaced from their homeland. Refugees who have to sometimes travel many thousands of miles in search of a safe, welcoming harbor. And although we read about that, hear about that quite a lot, we don't always take the time to immerse ourselves in the experience of individual refugees and what they experience, the kind of trauma or terror or chaos or war that forces them to leave, in some cases, the only home they've ever known. And we often also don't take a real close look at the experience of an individual refugee trying to make their way into a strange new land, such as the United States of America. I really appreciate the sensitive way in which Susan Hartman has written a new book called City of Refugees, the story of three newcomers who breathed life into a dying American town. The American town in question is Utica, New York. And Susan Hartman has followed, in particular, three different immigrants or refugees who have found their way to this city in New York. And I so appreciate also the long view. That is, she follows them over the course of a number of years, and thus the portrait that she draws of them is even richer than it would otherwise be. Susan Hartman is an award-winning writer who has covered all kinds of stories related to immigration, immigrants, and refugees. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Newsday, the Christian Science Monitor, among others. And she teaches, actually, in Columbia University's MFA writing program. And this new book, again, is titled City of Refugees, the story of three newcomers who breathed life into a dying American town, published by Beacon Press. Susan Hartman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if you could talk first about what has drawn you to this particular beat, if we want to call it that. That is, you write extensively about immigrants and where they tend to gather and live and what their lives are like. You've done so for years. Did anything in particular sort of get you started on focusing on this particular kind of community or these kind of stories? And what continues to draw you to these stories?
Yeah. Well, I think probably living in New York City and seeing so many different communities, these intimate communities, whether it's, let's say, a group of peddlers on the street selling all kinds of stuff, food and watches in Brooklyn, or you know, I think that it's just being drawn to these stories that are just all around you. And people on the margins, I think, have just interested me. So I'm just curious, how do people get through their days? All the details of people's lives, that's what really interests me.
So tell us what drew you to this community in New York State in the first place. I believe it was around the year 2014 that you first wrote about this city and some of its immigrants for the New York Times. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I had a link with this city before because I had gone to school at Hamilton College, which is upstate, very near Utica. And I've been intrigued by Utica because it seemed sort of asleep. It was a place where on a Saturday you could not get a cup of coffee, was depressed economically. And so I would keep visiting it over the years. It was this kind of down and out, but interesting city. And then in 2013, I got a call from a stranger who said he was actually an economics professor at Hamilton, and he knew I wrote about immigrant communities, and he said, did you know that Utica has become a city of refugees? And I had not. And he said, if you come up sometime, I will show you around and you can see how it's changed. So that really excited me. And I think he called on a Tuesday. I was in the car on Friday and I went up. And so that was my first visit. And he drove me around and I saw tiny ethnic restaurants that had popped up, a mosque that had been carved out of an abandoned Methodist church. These signs of life, of vitality in the city where there hadn't been much going on. So there were about 40 different countries represented in the city. Thousands of refugees had come. Starting in the 70s, there were waves of different refugees. And yeah, so that was the beginning of my becoming intrigued.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment a little more about Utica. And I appreciate the detail with which you explain the deterioration or decline of this community, which had once been quite vibrant, but then was hit by kind of a wave of significant economic setbacks. And you describe it more than once as a city that, in a sense, is part of America's Rust Belt, where once there was a vibrant manufacturing life that faded to all but nothing. And it sounds like the city of Utica was especially hard hit. Give us some sense of just how steep and painful a decline Utica experienced and roughly the years in which that decline occurred.
Yeah. Well, really starting in the 1960s, the manufacturing companies started leaving. GE, there are all kinds of large plants. They went south, and other Rust Belt cities were experiencing the same thing. So people started leaving Utica. It had been a place of about 100,000 at its peak, and then it was 60,000, which is, like, I know Buffalo at that point, around that point, lost about half of its population. And then arson became a huge issue because houses were worth so little, people had no money. So some people would torch their houses for the insurance payments. So there were fires everywhere, and this went on for decades, and it really got so terrible in the 90s that a strike force came into being to try to turn it around and track down arsonists in new ways. And then the city started to change. So it had hundreds of these abandoned buildings, burned buildings, and the refugees coming in would restore them. The Bosnians came with building skills and education, and they would work two jobs. buy a house for not much money and work day and night renovating it, putting in porches and roofs. So the city began to look differently. And then the waves of other groups who came, there have been so many waves, Vietnamese, Sudanese, Burmese, Somali Bantu, Iraqi. They also eventually bought houses and renovated them. And yeah, so that's been a huge change.
In the chapter titled In Bloom, you write, Utica became a refugee magnet by accident. Explain what you mean by that.
Okay, because it wasn't a master plan. There was one woman named Roberta Douglas, and she helped resettle one Amerasian. She had become very interested in how Amerasians were treated in Vietnam. And then along with Catholic Charities in Syracuse, she started resettling hundreds of Amerasians, and then later working with others, established the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees, which is now called the Center. So, yeah, it began with one man who was resettled, and now a quarter of the population of Utica is refugees. So it's extraordinary.
You also say that, in a sense, we shouldn't be surprised because Utica has always been a city of immigrants. And, of course, we can point to all kinds of different cities and towns in America where this could be said. In fact, all kinds of places this could be said. But it sounds like it was particularly true when it came to Utica, New York.
Yeah, at the turn of the century, Italians, Germans, Poles, Irish settled in Utica, working in factories. It was an enormous knitting factory center. And they also started small businesses eventually. I remember this one man telling me that his grandfather was the first person to sell lemon ices on the street, you know, calling out lemon ices. And then that grandpa started a salumeria. So that was a pattern. So Uticans know about that pattern. They remember. And so I feel there's a kind of sympathy among many for the refugees. So that makes it kind of a unique situation. Of course, I'm sure there's some resentment, but there's a lot of pride also.
Right. In this same chapter, one thing that I really appreciate is how you describe how certain kinds of immigrants from particular countries, at least generally speaking, succeeded more or succeeded more easily or more quickly, perhaps, than immigrants or refugees that came from other countries. That, for instance, the Bosnians were, by and large, the most successful group, while there were other groups that maybe struggled a bit more, such as the Somali Bantus, for instance. And I so appreciate the nuance with which you're telling this story, because I think a lot of us kind of simplistically think of immigrants and refugees coming from someplace else. We kind of think of them all in a wash of generalities. And you're trying to help us kind of understand the specific sort of flavor of various groups in terms of what their experience was like of trying to assimilate into American life.
Yes. You know, as I mentioned, the Bosnians coming with educations and building skills, many were from very middle-class backgrounds. They had nice apartments and cars, and they wanted to recreate the life they had. Now, the Somali Bantus, let's say, coming from the refugee camps, who had been persecuted for a long time in Somalia, They did not have, the Somali dancers did not have the status or privileges of the Somalis. And they'd been locked out of schools. They had no health care. So they were really starting from scratch. And in the camps, they had no stoves. They cooked in mud ovens in the backyard. They grew some of their own vegetables. They were pretty much in one- and two-room houses. They were not building things, so they didn't necessarily know how to build. And so they were really strangers in a strange land. And the amazing thing is how quickly they really have adapted. It took a while, but they learned how to use computers. They learned how to use all the things in their homes, which were so strange to them initially, you know, stoves and toilets, showers, electricity. And now, about 60% of the Somali Bantus own their own homes in Utica, and their children are starting to go to college. So it's really remarkable. Yeah, there was a learning curve, and that would be true for, let's say, the Karen, who are coming from camps as well. The Karen are an ethnic minority in Burma. They were persecuted, and they also very hardworking and are in certain ways really thriving, and they're very education oriented. They really push their kids so that the next generation is doing well. But let's say the Bosnians, who have been there two generations, they now are, they're in a whole range of professions. They are restaurateurs and contractors, doctors, nurses, teachers. Yeah, they're very much respected in Utica.
I enjoyed a passage in the book in which you're talking about one of the three immigrants on which you focus especially closely, Marisha, who works in an ESL, English as a Second Language program in the school. And one day she is busy, not so much talking specifically about learning English, but in more of kind of a cultural presentation, trying to explain to some of her students or clients about what it means to go to the doctor, what a typical American doctor's appointment is like. And of course, we don't stop to think about how mystifying something as basic as that could be for somebody who comes from a very different culture. Explain, for instance, how challenging this kind of situation might potentially be.
Oh, in just every way, it could be very frightening. Refugees don't want to ask questions and draw attention to themselves or complain, because in the past they haven't been able to do that. You're in trouble. So Marcia, in that class, she's trying to teach them to speak up if they have questions about their bodies, to write down the questions, and she gives them examples. She talks about herself. She says, if I have a headache, I have to remember, write it down so I can tell the doctor. If you feel thirsty all the time, she says, that could be a problem. Tell the doctor. And, you know, just the whole thing, she lets them know how long it will take, that it's really kind of a fast visit at the doctor. And then she helps them practice. She says, raise your right hand, you know, cough. She teaches them how to do all the things that they will be doing in the doctor's office. And they look at her with such respect as if she's a doctor. They actually, in that chapter, ask her questions, you know, teacher, what do I do if my child wants this or this? And Marcia answers the question. She says, do you give them sweets? That's not good. You know, so it's such an important role these ESL teachers have. And often they are actors. You know, they act this stuff out. They're very entertaining. because they want to engage, and especially at this particular center in Utica, they love their students. And let's say Marcia was a refugee herself. She had sat in one of those chairs in the classroom 20 years ago. So, you know, I found that very interesting, that here the tables are turned, and here she is, and she is a success. She's such a wonderful model for the children, the students. And she really achieved a great dream. When I first knew her, she had this thought. She wanted to have a cafe. She made wonderful pastries and cakes. But, I mean, a lot of people want to have a cafe, and a lot of cafes fail. Well, she baked all night, starting her own home bakery on the first floor of her house, and she did that for years. And then by the end of the book, she has opened an amazing cafe, which has become a center for Native Uticans, for refugees, and so she's quite extraordinary.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Susan Hartman, who is the author of a book called City of Refugees, the story of three newcomers who breathed life into a dying American town. In this book, Susan Hartman focuses on three refugees in particular, in order to tell kind of the larger stories of the vibrant immigrant community that is part of Utica, New York, a struggling city in the so-called Rust Belt of America that has seen something of a rebound, thanks in large measure to the influx of thousands upon thousands of immigrants. Susan Hartman, I'm curious about your choice to write about Utica and the experience of the many immigrants there, in a sense, through the eyes of three specific immigrants to such a large degree. I really do think it works, but of course, there would be all kinds of other choices you could have made as the author in terms of how to tell this story. And one would have been to not really focus on anybody in particular. I'm curious about that choice that you made. How do you, what did you think was right about that choice? I mean, how do you think that ended up serving the cause of telling this story well?
Yeah. Well, I always focus on one person, two people, three people in a story, because I think that that's a way to engage the reader. And I just like to have the reader, you know, see the drama of one person's life, and then you can make your own, you can come to your own conclusions about their experience, how universal it might be. But I'm also giving the reader a kind of a mural, because there's a backdrop of police officers and firefighters, the mayor. In other words, I did interview at least 100 other people, and they pop in and form, in a way, a kind of Greek chorus. I have some people who are threaded throughout the book. There's one man, John Zabi, who's kind of oral historian of the town. He's always making comments. I think he's very, has a lot to say. There's a woman, Carmela, who owns an old-fashioned Italian bakery. She's been sitting behind the counter for about 50 years, watching everything go by. She has her comments. I have newcomers who have come to Utica hoping to, they're coming from downstate, from Brooklyn, wanting to open a business, and they do. So you see them as well. You see some old timers, and what do they make of the newcomers? So I tried to give a feel for the whole city. I even ran into a man who calls himself Kevin the Kite Man, who's drifted into Utica, and he makes handmade kites and flies them, and he's just the kind of a street character, but he's part of Utica too, and I spend an afternoon with him. So I hope there's a richness in terms of other characters, but definitely I think what's just so engaging is a story of a person's life. So here I have three stories, these three people and their families, and I was riveted by them. So I hoped others would be too. You know, as a writer, as you're sitting alone in your room writing this whole thing up for a few years, you know, sometimes you have your doubts. What am I doing? You know, but I felt strongly that this was the way I wanted to tell the story.
I think it works beautifully. We should have you say a few words about each of these three immigrants upon whom you spend an exceptional amount of time and to whom you give special focus. And let's begin with Marisha, since we've already mentioned her as someone who worked in an ESL program and opened her own home bakery and ultimately opened a beautiful cafe. Tell us more about Marisha's backstory, what brought her to Utica and where she came from.
Yeah, so she was from Bosnia. She was raised by her mother, a single mother. And from her point of view, she had an idyllic home life, a very loving mother. Then when the war started, she was just about to graduate. Her prom was canceled. And her mother sent her and her sister to Croatia for safety, because young women in a nearby town were being raped. So she's frightened. She wanted to save her daughters. And everyone figured it would be just a short amount of time away, maybe a few weeks. But it ended up being more than a year, 2 years, that the mother and daughters were apart. And that was very traumatic for Marcia. She loved her mother. And then they reunited in the United States. And soon after that, her mother got cancer and died. So there's loss in her background and also tremendous ebullience. She's just a very radiant person, very resilient, loves her own children and her husband. She has four children. Her husband had been in a concentration camp in Bosnia. He was a soldier. So he also, there's trauma there, there's damage, but he also, he has recovered. Many refugees live with pain, and in a way they're self-treating. They don't tend to go to therapists. They manage or just plain suffer. But in this case, they pull together as a team. That was very inspiring to me, to see how this family works. Whether it's the house they bought that they all worked on, the restaurant where they all work. They're tremendously ambitious people, very community-minded. And they just really have thrived. But they are not ordinary people. They're everyday people, and that they didn't start out with huge privileges, but they are so resourceful. Yeah, so you have to say they're extraordinary in their energy, in the way they see things, in their optimism.
And you do say at one point that the Bosnians have now been in the city of Utica for two generations. And
yeah.
Of course, so that makes some difference as well, when they have been part of a community for so long. But it's interesting, in a later chapter in the book, you write this: Marisha has been in the United States for 24 years. But when she is introduced to someone, she explained, it's never, where do you live? Where do you work? Where do you go to school? It's always, how long have you been here?
Right.
Which is interesting. I mean,
that's
for someone
right.
to be such a part of the community for such a long time and yet seen as an outsider. In fact, a little later you say in that same chapter, like many immigrants and refugees, Marisha feels suspended between two worlds.
Yeah, I think most refugees feel that way. And really, her eyes welled just a bit with tears when she said that, about how she's never asked, you know, what work do you do? You know, how many kids do you have? But it's always, where are you from? And she said to me, I can't help it. I have an accent. She said, should I write it on my chest? I'm Bosnian. you know, it was really very painful for her that she isn't seen first as a person. But, I mean, in a way, she accepts it. This is just the way it is. It's still hurtful, though. Mm. And so part of her push, her ambition, I think, is, you know, to show she's just like anybody else. She can have what other people have. She wants what other people have. She can be as much a part of the community. Mm.
Let's talk next about Ali, A-L-I, although I hasten to add that is not his real name. You have changed his name and the name of really everybody associated with him and his story that you talk about in the book. And I think when you explain where Ali comes from and a bit about his background, people will understand why you felt the need to safeguard his identity.
Yeah, it was for security reasons. He had worked as a interpreter for ABC News in Baghdad during the war. He had worked with Peter Jennings and other journalists. So he was always at risk. He had had death threats. And I actually used the real names of his girlfriend and her family. For some reason, he felt that was okay, but his relatives and his own name he wanted changed. So I was very interested in Ali. He's a very reserved man, and there's a kind of shadow of war hanging over him. He was always drawn back to Iraq, and once I got to know him and knew he would be one of my main characters, and I was following around as he began a life with this American woman who he loved. They had a nice apartment. He joined a mosque. He was becoming close with her daughter. He was still thinking about going home and working as an independent contractor for the Allied forces fighting terrorism. And then I lost him as a character. He did go back, and he was supposed to have a contract for just a year. That became 2 years. It became 3 years. And I hung around waiting for him because he was so important in the story. And I found I could tell his part of the story while he was away through his girlfriend, who was getting emails from him. And also, he would visit every once in a while, and I would come for a couple of those visits. So with his story, I was always fascinated. Would he really become American? Would he always feel torn in half? So this was, you know, this is very fascinating to me, and it seems also to cast a bigger picture. You know, many people do go back. They go back and forth. And he really was never able to be completely here.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found intriguing about his story is that he and his brother were quite different from each other in that his brother was much more of a traditional Middle Eastern man. That's the way Ali described him.
Yeah.
And whereas Ali himself, at least by comparison, was more oriented to the West, and you tell us that Ali fell in love with Western culture when he was 4 years old. Explain what happened when he was 4 years old that, in a sense, lit this spark of interest in him that is still there to this day.
Yeah, he heard a Beatles song at his aunt's house, and he was just riveted. I mean, I could relate to that because I remember when I first heard the Beatles. But he then became obsessed with Western music, and he dressed like a Westerner. He loved hip-hop. So even as he was in Baghdad, he was patterning himself after an American teenager, and he had posters of movie stars on his walls. And actually, it was only when he came here as a refugee that he really rediscovered himself as an Arab man and began to love Arab music and more and more learned to love Arab food. So he synthesized himself as a Westerner and someone from, you know, the Mideast. But initially, he was just, yeah, he just saw himself as a cool Westerner, yeah. Mm. And the brother, the relationship with the brother, who was very different, was very important to him. And there's a tragedy that happened to his brother, and that really is something that affected him deeply, yeah. Mm.
I want to mention a really interesting moment in the book. And this is at a point when you are talking about how the whole climate of our country around issues of immigration and immigrants changed so dramatically with the election of Donald Trump as president. And, of course, one of the hallmarks of his campaign platform was of tightening the influx of immigrants into the United States. And, of course, much of what he said fostered feelings of concern and suspicion about at least many of the immigrants streaming into our country. Interestingly enough, if I remember correctly, you tell us that Ali voted for Donald Trump, unlike his girlfriend Heidi, who voted for Hillary Clinton. But I just thought that was really interesting because, I think a lot of us might leap to simplistic conclusions that every single immigrant or refugee would never even think of voting for Donald Trump because of the way because of his rhetoric around the whole issue of immigration. And, of course, that it is a big mistake to leap to those kind of conclusions.
Yeah. I was also very interested in that. He liked his economic plan. Upstate is depressed, so he had hopes that Trump would stimulate the economy. And, so he was able to sort of ignore some of the rhetoric, which drove his girlfriend crazy because she would say at the dinner table, "Can't you hear the racism?" But he felt it was a good idea to concentrate on his economic policies. He voted for him. And in their household, it wasn't a really divisive issue because they're so close. They were able to talk about this. The girlfriend actually had been a Bernie supporter even before Hillary. So they're very different politically. But also one thing his girlfriend would say at the dinner table is that he is used to kind of authoritarian figures from, you know, he grew up partly under Saddam Hussein, and he just has a different perspective.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Young teenager, and in just many respects, kind of a surprising yet fascinating presence in this book. Tell us more about her backstory and why you were drawn to her, and maybe more specifically, drawn to her particular story.
Yeah. Well, she was a rebel, very smart, and was making her own decisions in a family that was very bound by traditions, although her mother, in certain ways, was a rule breaker, but she wanted her children. She had a lot of children. She had 11 children at the time when I met the family. She wanted them to follow Somali Bantu rules, and one of those rules is that girls should stay in the house and help the mother and take care of the kids, help cook. And she also wanted them to do well in school, but the idea of going to the mall with friends, going to the movies, you know, going, meeting someone for a Coke or something, dessert, No, that was not considered appropriate. Dating was not considered appropriate. So she had her own ideas, and she had some other sisters who were more tradition-bound. So within that family, she was a maverick. So, yeah, I found that very interesting. I think she's very easy to relate to for most, you know, young people. And one of the surprises is that she did carve her own path and had a rift with the mother, and yet at the end they reunite. That really surprised me, and, you know, I thought that was really wonderful. The mother changes a little bit, the daughter changes a little bit, and their love came back.
Hmm. Their relationship is endlessly fascinating because there is this strong connection between them, and there is a sense in which the daughter is devoted to the mother even when the mother is driving her crazy and by all outward appearances not treating her very lovingly, or certainly not very affectionately, and not in the at least the kind of the standard ways that we think about that. I should think it was a challenge for you as the writer to be true and fair about this particular relationship and the two flawed, complicated people at either end of it.
Yeah, that was the word fair. You know, I wanted to be fair, to put it in the context. The mother feels that the daughter is acting out and she wants to protect the daughter, but the daughter is on a path that she does not support. And the mom is coming out of a particular culture. She's working along the lines of what she knows. You know, it's not cruelty. She feels the daughter is being disrespectful by making these choices. And the daughter, of course, doesn't feel that. And they do love each other. Also, the mom is disappointed. She has ambitions for this particular daughter. She does see her as special, as bright. And what is she doing? She's doing poorly in school. She's doing things behind her back. She might even be seeing a boyfriend, you know. So, and she has a lot of other children to take care of. That's part of it, too. So, yeah, I just tried to put it in context and, not judge. And obviously, I have an affection for both. You know, you hang out with people for so long, there is admiration and affection, even though you're a journalist, you're doing the best you can to be unbiased, but, you know, you're also a human being, and I think it comes across that there's a caring that I have for my subjects.
In a section of the book at the very, very end, which you title About the Process, you describe the way in which you set about interacting with the people who we meet in your book. Describe that just in a nutshell to our listeners in terms of the kind of conversations you would have with them over what sort of span of time and also some of the boundaries you tried to set up in order to make this, you know, ultimately a relationship, if you will, that was going to benefit and not undermine your project.
Yeah. I set up boundaries. For instance, I was not there all the time. I was not insisting on being there when people were having very, very, very private things that they felt nobody should see. I would go up there for about a week at a time, and I would just see how it went. sometimes I would see my subjects a couple of times during that week, or maybe once, or sometimes I would skip seeing somebody if they weren't available. So I didn't press myself. I wanted them to feel good about this process. And I was a fly on the wall. People just were so used to me sitting in a corner of a couch and scribbling. I do write longhand. I write down every word. I'm used to it. I write very fast. And the amazing thing was that there was so little irritation, you know, among any of the people. You know, it was really it just worked out very well. And, it's always tricky. You know, you are not ever, as a journalist, you're not paying people. You know, if you are invited to a wedding, of course, then if you're a guest at a wedding, of course you bring a gift. But, you know, you're always trying to, you know, set boundaries and be ethical.
Well, I appreciate the care with which you have gone about telling these many and various stories. And of course, your book ultimately takes us close enough to the present day that the ugly scourge of the COVID-19 pandemic figures into this story. And of course, there are other changes as well. Ultimately, do you think these three principal players welcomed their story being told in this public way?
Well, that's to be seen. You know, the book will be published June 7th. I think that Marcia is particularly happy about it. Her restaurant is doing so well. I think many people in the book, because there are, you know, other people. There's a Karen man who talks about trauma, and he actually takes me to visit a woman who has been abused by her husband. That woman and he were both telling stories that were very, very personal and hard, and felt better having told the stories. So I think there was a sense that telling the story was a good thing for them.
Well, I appreciate so many facets of this book that is really illuminating at every turn in so many different ways. And I appreciate in some ways the heart and soul of the book is a quote from the grandmother of, I believe, Marisha, who used to say, "Your neighbors are more important than your brother and sister. If you need help, who will help you? Your neighbor." And, of course, this is a story about being neighbors to people you know very well and to sometimes people who are complete strangers who have come from someplace far, far away. The book, again, is City of Refugees, the story of three newcomers who breathed life into a dying American town. The book is published by Beacon Press, the author, Susan Hartman. Susan Hartman, congratulations on a really, really fine book. And thank you so much for being my guest today on The Morning Show. I was so glad we got to talk. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, as we continue rebroadcasting some of our favorite author interviews from 2022, you'll hear my conversation with Marshall John Fisher, a sports writer whose book is called 17-0. It examines the amazing season of the 1972 Miami Dolphins. It is still the only time in NFL history that an NFL team has achieved perfection, that is, a completely undefeated season. No losses, no ties, culminating in a dramatic Super Bowl victory. it was a difficult road, and nobody foresaw the Dolphins achieving that at the start of the season. John Marshall Fisher's book is also in a